Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the third part of the Changes Mother Mother miniseries with me, Annie McManus. So, excuse any strange noises in the background. I live very close to a school. I have the window open. It is a scorching hot day and it's break time. So if you hear any blood-curdling screams, it's just the children having fun. Hope you're doing good. Hope you're enjoying the miniseries so far. So far, we've spoken to Francisco Garcia about missing people and Sophie Haywood about single motherhood, two themes central to my novel, Mother Mother. This week, it's all about grief. For Nikesh Shukla, it took 10 years from his mother dying for him to be able to make sense of his grief. It was only when his daughters were born and he began to write a book to them and for them that he noticed his grief for his mother creeping back to the forefront of his mind. The book he wrote is called Brown Baby. I found it so, so touching. I was crying for a good bit of it. It's just so gorgeous and remarkable for its vulnerability. It's a memoir about the dual experience of becoming a parent and reckoning with the loss of his own mum. It's full of these moments of sadness, rage, just utter desperation, the whole gamut of emotions that will be so familiar to people who have lost someone irreplaceable. But it's also, and kind of fundamentally, a book about finding joy in the world, even when that seems like the hardest thing to do. That's really the message Nikesh was trying to get through to his daughters, that even when the world seems like a very cruel place, which let's face it, it does a lot of the time, there are still things to wonder at, things to relish and drink in and be happy for. Myself and Nikesh spoke just a week before my own book came out, so Nikesh was really reassuring about me being my anxious first-time novelist. This is not his first rodeo. He's written his own novels, both for adults and children, and has compiled the award-winning essay collection, The Good Immigrant. He just got offered an MBE and turned it down, actually. He wrote an article in The Guardian about that. It's an interesting read. So yeah, we talked a lot about what it's like to be an author, what it's like to put a book out into the world, but we started, as Brown Baby itself does, with Nikesh's daughters. He just had a particularly sleepless night with his youngest and he was feeling the effects of that quite heavily. Enter the podcast, Nikesh Shukla.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's like, it feels like, you know, there's that sort of American style torture that they used to have, or they apparently have, where they'd play heavy metal really loudly to people to every time they were starting to fall asleep. It sort of feels like that. You kind of, you smash asleep and then you're wrenched awake and it's horrible. It's just, it makes me feel physically sick. So this morning I feel like what it was like to have a newborn.
How old are your girls now?
I've got a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old.
Okay. Yeah. I'm 8 and 4.
8 and 4.
So similar-ish. Okay, well, listen, we can talk about parenting a lot, and I'm sure we will, but let's talk about the book in question. And, you know, obviously, there is kind of running themes throughout both of our books that are kind of paralleled. In my book, there's so much about absent mothers in a very kind of visceral sense in terms of Mary going missing. And then also in a kind of quieter sense in that we learn about what it's like to grow up without a mother from a very young age. But what changes in your life, Nikesh, led you to write this book?
I didn't really ever imagine myself having kids. I didn't really think, it wasn't a consideration. It wasn't something I was actively opposed to or actively wanted to do. It was just something that I thought, that's something that other people are doing. But then having a kid, it changed so much for me. It really kind of crystallized for me what my life was about, what my life's work was about. Because around the same time that I was a young father, I just started doing youth work again. And so I think like the first big change for me was going back into youth work, because it really crystallized for me how important it is to support young people when they're coming through, especially when they don't have any voice, they don't have any access to opportunities, they don't have they don't have anyone to support them to kind of make mistakes and then help them learn from those mistakes, especially now when like we have such free and easy access to create content on platforms like Instagram and TikTok. You know, young people don't necessarily have the opportunity to learn their craft and practice their craft in a supported environment. And so going back into youth work and working on this youth magazine that I used to, really helped me to think about what I wanted my work to stand for, what I wanted my writing to stand for.
Mm. And then you had babies.
And then I had babies, yeah, pretty much around the same time that that happened. I think the week I found out that I was taking this job was the week we knew my wife was pregnant. And it was also the week that I was in Karachi at a literature festival, being driven around in like armored like jeeps and stuff. It was very, very strange. But also like, it was just like everything all at once kind of thing.
Yeah. And what, I guess it's good to get kind of an overview of the amount of time it took for you to write this book and your daughter's kind of growth in that time. So can you talk me through the kind of chronology of how long and where she was in age during it?
During the writing of Brown Baby. So in early 2018, I was briefly a columnist for The Observer magazine. And so this is a long story, but this is a podcast. That's what men on podcasts...
We love the long conversations.
Yeah, men on podcasts always have 20-minute long stories. That's our birthright. So in 2016, I put out a book called The Good Immigrant, which was a collection of essays about race and immigration in the UK, featuring essays by people like Riz Ahmed and Bim Adewumni and Reni Eddo-Lodge and loads of amazing people. And I went from being a comedy writer and youth worker to being like person that people would call upon to talk about race for a living. And I just spent like a year and a half to 2 years while my kid was really young, just touring the country, touring the world, talking about like race issues in the UK, especially post-Brexit. And I found it really hard. And I just found it like incredibly traumatic to be constantly be talking about all of this stuff. And so when I was asked if I wanted to become a columnist for The Observer, and it was based on an article that I'd written about my daughter not wanting to play with a doll because it was brown and she thought the brown was dirty. And I'd written this article for The Pool, and the editor of The Observer magazine had seen that and thought, well, maybe there's more stuff like this. You know, it's an interesting perspective, a father writing about, you know. And so she asked me what I wanted the column to be. And I was just so, I felt so bleak about the world and so sad and so angry. And I said, I want it to be about joy. I want to write about joy. And she said, that's great, but, you know, tell me more about it. And the more I talked about it, the more I realised that the column had this sort of central question. How do we raise our kids to be joyful in a world that feels so bleak, that I feel so sad and angry about? And that became those columns. And so through those columns, I talked about, you know, like the day-to-day pain of having young children and sleep deprivation. I talked about racism. I talked about my grief for my mother's death. I talked about all of these things. I was sort of building up these really sort of interesting, quite disparate columns. And when the column ended, an editor approached me and said, is there a book in this? And I was like, what do you mean? She said, do you want to write a memoir about being a parent? I was like, not really. I'm 38, dude. Like, who writes a memoir at 38? And also, like, my parenting journey wasn't particularly interesting. Like, nothing dramatic had happened. Everything had happened as it should have happened. There was no like big story there. It was literally just like in those sort of short bite-sized columns, like being a parent made me reevaluate how I saw the world. But, you know, this editor's brilliant, and she was also persistent, and she asked me a couple of times. And I was a bit like, you know what? I'm a big fan of that sort of epistolary tradition of writers like Ta-Nehisi Coates and James Baldwin. And, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates...
So writing letters, yeah. Like kind of writing in letter form.
And Ali Wong had just written this book called Dear Girls, which was her these hilarious letters she wrote to her daughters about her relationship with their dad. And... Yeah. You know, Between the World of Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates had actually been a huge source of inspiration for The Good Immigrant. And I thought, well, maybe I could just do that. Maybe I could write a letter to my daughters. And that would then force me to go, right, it doesn't need to be a traditional linear memoir because, like, it wouldn't be that interesting. But it would then allow me to talk about the stuff that kind of keeps me up at night, the stuff that fills me with such fear that
literally keeps you up at night and figuratively. Yeah,
and addressing it to my daughters would mean that I wouldn't be able to lie to them. I'd have to tell them the truth because, you know, I can't lie to them. And so the book emerged out of that, and out of knowing that I was going to write the book, I realized that in order to write about being a parent, I needed to write about being a child, and in order to write about being a child, I needed to finally a decade on, deal with my mum's death. And so, you know, it's part grief memoir, but it's also part memoir about raising our children to be joyful.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There
you go. Well done. Well done.
I got through it.
You did. You really did. You really did. I guess that's such a huge seismic thing to take on in terms of like deep diving into your feelings, really rummaging around in there and trying to articulate what's going on in your head, but also exposing those feelings to the world. Did you have any, doubts as you were writing to go like, fuck, this is too much? Or like, I don't think I'm ready mentally to write something like this.
Yeah, there are a couple of things I took out because they felt like they were just confessional stuff and I hadn't really processed them yet. What's been really, really interesting, because this is a book that is also talking about what it is to be a man, what it is to be a brown man now, and sort of re-evaluating the capacity for vulnerability that men should allow themselves to feel, and also re-evaluating the need for men to feel uncomfortable when they get stuff wrong and that be okay. And we can, you know, it's okay to feel uncomfortable and move past stuff. And like, I talk about a couple of incidents where, like, you know, one specific thing where I witness a thing happening to my daughters where people use some really kind of sexually aggressive language, and I text my friends, I'm like, oh my god, I know you guys always talk about all this stuff and I'm always with you and stuff, but I've just seen this thing. And they were like, yeah, well done for having daughters in order to understand how awful the world. And
yeah,
and I included that because I was just like, I felt really uncomfortable that they called me out on it, even though they did it lovingly because they're my close friends. Yeah. But I'm okay. I'm fine. I'm here. I'm still here. And it's what you kind of do next that counts. And, you know, there was a degree to which, like, writing all this stuff, honestly, sort of gave me this capacity to kind of address these things around, you know, masculinity, around grief, around mental health and all this stuff. Like, the thing that I didn't really think about too much in terms of the reaction to it, and I wish I had, because it has been quite difficult to talk about, is I write very honestly about my relationship with food, about how I used food as a way of helping me grieve for my mum. But I also, after The Good Immigrant came out and I was sort of touring a lot and tired from touring and tired from having a young child, I just developed this incredibly difficult relationship with food in a way that just, it didn't make me personally happy. And, you know, turns out not many men have written about their relationship with food. And so, like, I remember the first interview I did for this book and someone said, so how does it feel to tell the world that you have an eating disorder? And I was like, whoa, that is language that someone has put on this thing that I had not really considered.
Or tried to process or anything like this. It's that labeling, isn't it?
Yeah. And I hadn't given it that label, and I found all of that stuff really weird. But I think there's a degree to which when you write a memoir, and also when you write fiction, and you know this, like when you write fiction that comes from a really, really personal place, you put your heart on the page, but you also retain enough for yourself that you're not giving people everything. And readers do tend to feel a certain amount of entitlement to what's not on the page, which is quite an interesting relationship that you can sometimes have with your reader. But at the same time, you know, I've put my emotional truth on the page, but I haven't given my readers absolutely everything.
I'm interested in what you're saying about holding something back and the necessity to do that in order to kind of feel like ownership of yourself and your own story. How did you know how much to hold back? And was there a point where you were like, did you have to monitor that? Did you have to be like, oh, I mean, I guess you did. You said you had to bring stuff back and take stuff out.
Yeah, I think there's this, what I usually say in creative writing courses is like the first draft is always for yourself and every draft after that is about giving it to the reader.
Fascinating. That's so, because we interviewed Sophie Haywood for this and her book is also a memoir. And she said that her first draft was, she wrote it all out and then she realised, that's just for me. I now need to write an entirely different version of this for the reader.
I mean, you're probably feeling this at the moment. There's I really recommend listening to the Warren Zevon song, Keep Me In Your Heart For A While, because there's like this thing that happens. And I guess I'm just used to it now because I've been published a bunch of times. But I didn't understand this when my first novel came out, but mostly because my first novel is so wrapped up with the death of my mum, because they both happened in the same 7-day period. But when a book comes out, it doesn't belong to me anymore. And so what tends to happen is, instead of a feeling of elation that it's out, I always feel a little bit of grief because it just doesn't belong to me anymore. And because it doesn't belong to me anymore, it belongs to readers. And what happens is readers then project onto your book everything that they're going to project. You know, countless times readers will read things into your words that you haven't necessarily knowingly done, or feels like their experience and not yours. Or they'll go, why didn't you write about this? And you'll go, well, that's not the story that I wanted. And I've found that one of the ways of protecting myself in that instance is to just go, it doesn't belong to me. It belongs to readers. And the moment a reader engages with your work, it kind of remixes it a little bit. It becomes what they think of it. And, you know, to quote Jay-Z, by that point, I'm on to the next one, on to the next one, on to the next one, because I just feel like I want to retain the bit of my heart that sort of compels me to tell stories. And the way to do that is to kind of ensure that as soon as something comes out, I'm working on something new.
Yeah, forward motion. I get that. I felt a need to do that myself. We were talking now the week before Mother Mother comes out, and I'm starting to feel quite overwhelmed by just the whole experience, really. But what I'm finding is very helpful is just writing other stuff and feeling like the kind of escapism of that, and the kind of just the idea that I can be constructive in some way and control that.
The main thing to know is you've done a brilliant job. It's a brilliant novel, and it's so beautiful and so brittle and so painful in moments. And I think that the way you do that is really masterful. And the thing is, even now, the very nature of me saying this to you as we record a podcast the week before it comes out, you're probably going, I don't remember that bit. It's like, but that's because it kind of sort of mother kind of belongs to me and all the other readers now. And that's sort of like this weird thing that happens that no one really prepares you for. And so you do go through this sort of period of mourning for the original thing that made you go, I've got a story to tell.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So many feelings. I'm just trying to process them all. And what I'm trying to do is feel, just keep going back to the feeling of how amazing it felt to write it, and just focus on that and the writing of it. And everything else is wonderful or not wonderful, but at least I know that, it sounds so cheesy, but like I've kind of opened a door in my head of wanting to write, and I'm just like mad for it, basically.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Anyway, back to you, Nikesh. I wanted to ask you, you know, did writing Brown Baby change you? Now you have hindsight on it.
Yes, it did. It really fundamentally changed me in two ways. The first is, so as I mentioned, my mum died the week my first novel came out. It was very sudden and it was a real shock, and I was just very broken by it. And I didn't know what to do. And so I decided to just promote my novel, because that felt easy and doable, and it involved cocktails with writers and like sharing gossip and like getting drunk and like being a bit silly and all the rest of it. And that was a good enough distraction. But then as that went on, I just pushed it down and down and down and down. And then when my first child was born, suddenly I felt that absence, and I realized that I hadn't dealt with my mum dying, and it all just kind of erupted for me. And I was sort of, I didn't know how, where to put all of those feelings. I didn't accept at the time that I needed therapy, and I certainly didn't know how to kind of contain all this, you know, like the snake in the comedy jar, like it goes everywhere. It doesn't just sort of splurt upwards, it like explodes. And so when I was writing the book, I realized that in order to write about my mum, I needed to grieve for her properly, and in order to grieve for her properly, I needed to conjure her and I needed for her to live again on the page, and I needed for her to die, and I needed to feel the pain of how she died, and I needed to feel the pain of those final conversations, and I needed to feel viscerally that she had died. And it was incredibly painful to write, because this was like the goodbye I didn't feel like I'd had an opportunity to share. And it put me in a really dark, vulnerable place. You know, turns out like saving all the really dark shit you want to put in your book isn't conducive to going away to Berlin for a couple of days with a bottle of whiskey and a laptop and, you know, teaching during the day. But that's where I was, and it just put me in a really dark place. And then I handed it in and I edited it, and it was ready to come. It was done in February 2020, and it was supposed to come out in September 2020, and I was feeling really raw about everything. And then when the pandemic started and my publisher said, should we push this back a little bit, it gave me just a bit more time with the book, a bit more time before I gave it to readers. I just like got to sit with it a bit longer. And that final edit I did, where, like, you know, the big stack of like the typeset pages arrive in a big bundle and you go through it one more time with your fine line pen, that was the time I felt some closure about my mum's death. I'm not saying like it's all like flowers and meadows and Barry Manilow songs now, but I definitely felt a peace. I felt a calm. I felt like I'd worked through the thing I should have worked through earlier on. And it was a stark reminder that grief isn't linear, and grief, it doesn't happen neatly in a bundle in real time. And sometimes it does take 10 years, and that's okay. And sometimes you need to force the grief out through something like a construct, like art, like writing. And also, it's not necessarily the same. Look, just because I wrote it down and I felt a catharsis in that release, it's not the same as therapy, is an important lesson. But I did feel a sense of calm when I sent those pages back to my publisher in September of last year.
Yeah. Your mum is all the way through the book. And it's interesting how, you know, everything you write about when you're talking to your daughter, you just keep coming back to your mum and your thoughts of her and your memories of her. And it's so interesting, this kind of, you're kind of caught between grief and wonder all the way through the book. It's this kind of flip-flopping between sadness and awe. But I was interested in, like, you know, the idea of grief. Did writing about grief, as you say, it doesn't make everything okay, but does it change your experiences of grief?
Yeah, for me it did, because it, in those early drafts, I got to put everything on the page and I got to release everything that I'd ever held on to, every moment where, you know, my grief is hampered by a remembrance of the fact that my mum could be quite annoying most of the time. Or, like, you know, like, and that's the thing about, you know, conjuring a person. You don't, you know, in grief, in memoriam, we tend to romanticize like the great things about the person who's no longer with us, and we roll our eyes at the things that weren't as good, but we forget the really mundane things. We forget the day-to-day of them, we forget the routine of them, we forget things like the way they smell. I, you know, and I even forgot the way that she, my sister, and me would lie on the sofa, like, sort of intertwined, and watch ER than Friends, like, on Thursdays or Fridays or whenever it was, without fail. And that for me was like the safest I ever felt in my life, and like did it way into my like teens, to a point where like I'd be horrified to admit it at school, but like that's just, that was safety for me. And getting to like re-experience all of that stuff was really, really important, because it gives you a sense of who that person was and the weight of that person and like the physical presence that they played in your life and what that absence now means. And like, I think there's an argument to be made that, like, you know, having kids can sometimes, you know, it doesn't replace that absence, but it kind of like it stretches the gap between that absence and where you are, I think.
Hmm. I mean, that's another thing that comes up in the book is, obviously your child and your mom are connected, but you call her Ganga after the river that your mother's ashes were spread in. And producer Frank, we both read the book at the same time, and he made this point, which I thought was so good, is that at times you feel like a medium between your mother and your daughter. It's like you are trying to communicate how your mother would feel and say and behave to her. And sometimes you can't find the answers, and you're just really need, you just need her. But it's really interesting that you've become this person in the middle of them. Do you feel like you've succeeded in making your mum a part of your daughter's lives?
That's a really interesting reaction, because I think for me, the way I was thinking about it was like my daughter was the bridge between me and my mum, because she represented, like, she represents, like, you know, if the Ganges River is like the sort of the portal between the living and the those who have passed, and she sort of represents that connection between us. Because so much of like my yearning for my mum was often this kind of, oh God, like, I don't have any answers. If only I had my mum. Like, because my dad, I'm not going to go to my dad for advice on parenting. He was a very absent parent, as I discuss in the book. And, you know, part of the book is me kind of reconciling that with who he is as a person and being okay with that. But, you know, my mum had equipped me for all of this stuff. I just need, and, you know, so like there was this sort of quite naturalistic way that I thought about myself as a dad, because my mum had sort of prepared me for all this stuff. And like, I think, you know, spiritually, like, my mum lives through like the way we are, you know, and how she raised me, and I guess all of the stuff that I know about her as a person, because like part of the kind of the journey of the book, and a lot of this I didn't end up putting in the book because I felt like it wasn't my story to tell, was I got really fascinated by the idea of who my mum was when she wasn't my mum. Because it's so, like, you know, I'm obviously, like, I don't mean to sort of state an obvious thing to someone who is a mother, but like that sort of loss of identity that kind of happens, particularly for mums. And she was just my mum, and I really wanted to know, like, who was the guy whose name she wrote all over her exercise books, and like, did she have posters on her walls, and like, if she had a burn book when she was 13 years old, who would be in a burn book and why? Like, all those kind of things that you want to know that kind of give you a sense of a person. And a really beautiful thing happened, like, at the start of lockdown. My mum's best friend just sent me a random, like, WhatsApp forward in the way that Indian aunties do. And I just replied, I think I was just feeling quite delicate that day. And I just replied and said, would you feel comfortable telling me about what my mum was like when she was a teenager? And she just, over the course of the day, just started sending me all these voice notes about my mum. And like, I learned all this incredible stuff that I just hadn't known. Like, my mum's best friend and my mum and a bunch of their friends took the Bradford Telegraph and Argus to task in the 60s, because every time they reported on a crime by a non-white person, they always specified their race. And they felt like it was gaslighting, and they petitioned for them to stop, and they eventually did. And like, this was all stuff that my mum was doing when she was a teenager that I never knew anything about. But then, like, drawing a line between that and like what I was doing like 4 or 5 years ago with stuff like The Good Immigrant, I was like, wow, like, all of this stuff was just in me, you know.
Let's keep going and talk about, you know, you mentioned that kind of period of being a spokesperson for, you know, being wheeled out on various shows and having to kind of speak on behalf of, you know, everyone marginalized in the UK. No biggie, no pressure, put it all on you. That must have been really tough. But you are someone who, you know, is well known whenever you do any research on you, Nikesh, that you are one of these people who where community is really important. And you like to pay it forward. You like to kind of give back everything you've learned and teach and guide and encourage like the new generations of writers. Why is that important to you?
Oh, thank you. I think a bunch of things. I think it was just the way I was raised by my mum to always think about community. And that's always been in me. I am also, like, you know, I went to private school for a bit, and it was a real sort of source of struggle for my parents. They really wanted me to go to this school. And I went, and the thing that I took away from it was like the privilege that I had in terms of like networks and support and like indulgence of things that wouldn't necessarily had the support structure for in like the comprehensive schools or the state schools near where I grew up, like the arts and stuff. I felt like I've had a degree of privilege here, and it's incumbent on me to share it. Like, it's important that I share it.
Mm. Can I ask, I mean, I interviewed Candice Carty-Williams for this podcast, and we were talking about her history working in publishing and being the only black woman in the room, the only black person in the room, so much in her situation. And then having that kind of just like, oh, well, you could be the diversity gal. Like, you can be the one that, because like, you know, everything, you're like, you're part of a community. So maybe you could like set something up, which she did. But obviously there's a question of why should it be always on the person of color? Why should it be the brown person, the black person doing that? Did you ever feel that? Like, from inside the industry? I mean, obviously from outside, you have all your contacts and you have a community, but from inside, I can, you know, I know you set up a prize for writers. Like, what was the kind of context behind that?
Yeah, like, look, it's always incumbent on the people. This is the thing about like trying to fix an imbalance in an industry. It's always incumbent on the people who feel the imbalance viscerally rather than the people who...
Yeah, there's an easy, lazy thing where you go, well, like, you know, we don't really know what we're doing. Yeah. So maybe, you know,
And I don't want to step on your lived experience. So I would just signal boost you. And it's like, well, you know, white people are the ones who are going to end racism. ultimately. But here's a really interesting story about the prize that I set up and the prize that Candy set up, because they were set up in the same year. So I got so sick of like constantly being the sort of the misery doom monger of diversity, like talking about the lack of diversity. And I just felt like there are actually writers with books coming out, and they must just feel so miserable that anytime anyone talks about non-white writers, they just talk about the lack of, when these people are already there. And so I was talking about this with another writer called Sunny Singh and an organization called Media Diversified, and we were like, well, why don't we do something celebratory for a change rather than everything always just being miserable? Why don't we set up a prize and we can celebrate instead of just like constantly being miserable about stuff? And I'm about to tell you an interesting story about how power works in the UK. Strap in, guys. So on the night we were going to award our first ever award, which went to Jacob Ross for the Bone Readers, I was adminning the prize. And this is a like thing, I was doing all of it for free. Like
all of the reading, all of the time, all of the admin. God,
yeah, so like this room was like filled with books, and I was like going to the post office and paying my own money to like send them out to like judges and stuff like that. And on the night that 6:30, the prize was announced at 7:30. At 6:30, I received an email from the lawyers for the Equalities and Human Rights Commission saying that an MP had brought this prize to their attention and said that it discriminated against white writers and we may be discriminatory, and therefore the prize may be illegal, and so they need to conduct a full investigation. And I tell you what, all the melanin dropped from my face. Like I was like, oh
my God, my,
what do we do? Like, and I called Sunny over, and this is where Sunny is just like, she's so amazing. She was just like, let's just open that email tomorrow. We set this up to celebrate. Let's celebrate tonight.
But like, it's at that point, it's so interesting, because at that point, right, you know, if you were in a position of power and money, you would be able to call a hotshot lawyer and be like, what's the deal here? You know what I mean?
Wait till you hear how this story plays out, my friend. It gets really fucked up. Because So over the weekend, she and I are like, what do we do? We speak to a lawyer that follows us both on Twitter, and she's like, I'll take this on pro bono. I'll sort this out for you. No probs. And so what we had to do is we had to provide loads of evidence to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission of our need to exist, that there was an imbalance in publishing and all this stuff. And it just felt like, you know, there's that Toni Morrison quote, the very function of racism is to distract you, to keep you from doing the work that you're doing. There's always one more thing and one more thing and one more thing. And it just felt like we'd built up this steam with this prize. Like, people were excited about it. It was year one, and the Equalities and Human Rights Commission came along and said, can you just remind us why you exist again? So then we have to spend the time gathering all of the information to, you know, and we were like, look, all of this stuff is freely available. But we gathered it because, like, we were scared. We were so intimidated. The lawyers for the Equalities and Human Rights Commission say that what we're doing is discriminatory. And we sent all of this stuff. And then, like, I spent a summer waiting for them to kind of tell us whether what we were doing was illegal or not. And I didn't know what the consequences were, and I was terrified. And, you know, we had this new baby, and then our lawyer gets an email from them that basically is like two lines saying, "We've concluded our investigation. What you're doing is legal. You may continue."
Oh my God.
Hold on.
Can't you fucking sue them?
Hold on.
For mental stress?
This is only halfway through the story. Because it gets weirder. So, like, we were like, is that it? Is that it? And so our lawyer, this was a shout out to Kieran Dorker, who handled this, because she was such a badass. She had done a freedom of information request to find out, see the correspondence that the MP had sent. And also she and we were like, look, Equalities and Human Rights Commission is a statutory body regulated by the government to determine discrimination issues in this country. You should know that there is an imbalance in publishing. It's been very widely publicised all over the press. So why were you on the back foot with this? So we called a meeting with them. So just before the meeting, we saw their correspondence with Philip Davis MP. I'm okay to say this because, like, it's all been in the press and stuff because we talked about it. And he had written to them in pencil, scrawly handwriting in pencil of the privileged dickhead man. Sue me, Phil, sue me. And he had named us, and he had named the Guardian and Fourth Estate B4 AIM Prize as discriminatory against white writers. And so when we spoke to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, we were like, oh, yeah. I was like, this was a really horrible experience for us. And they were like, what do you mean? We were just looking for information. And we said, have you ever received a letter from the lawyers of a government body telling you that the work you're doing is discriminatory? And they were like, no. And we were like, would you find that intimidating? And they said, yeah, I suppose. And then we talked about it, and we got them up to speed with what was going on in publishing. But then just before we finished, one of us asked, I can't remember who it was, one of us was like, so how did the Guardian and HarperCollins react when you sent them the same letter, because they were named in the correspondence?
Yeah, in the original pencil.
And they said, oh, we didn't send them a letter. And in that moment, I understood how power works in this country, because Sunny and I and Media Diversified, like Sunny and I, we're just like two random writers trying to do something nice for the community. Media Diversified was a grassroots, amazing media organization that sort of was funded by readers, and we're the little dogs compared to The Guardian and HarperCollins, who probably have like a legal team on staff to deal with all this stuff. And so, like, they'd gone after us to see if we'd fold, and then if there was a case with us, they'd go after the people who could have shut them down with a proper legal team. And I was just like, that's how power works. See if the little guy will fold and then go after the big people.
But I'm just so shocked that in this day and age, someone who is in a position of power and is supposed to know how the world works could actually think in the way that he thought, that he could actually think that was discriminatory. That scares the fucking bejesus out of me, to be honest.
I mean, he is a Conservative MP who doesn't believe in positive discrimination, but it taught me a lot about how power works and what happens when people club together and try and build a community to kind of address an imbalance that power structures want to keep in place.
Nikesh, can I ask you if you're writing anything at the moment and if you have any plans to release anything?
Yeah, so I started teaching on a creative writing course a couple of years ago. And because I'd always been critical of like creative writing courses that cost thousands of pounds because of like what that means for access. But, you know, I'm also a writer who really believes in earning money to put a roof over my head. I decided to make my creative writing notes free. So like I'd prepare the class every week and then I would just send it out as like a Substack newsletter. And it built up quite a big following quite quickly. And my editor for Brown Baby was like, do you want to do this as a book? So I'm working on a creative writing book, which is interesting because like the first draft of it was definitely like, it was a badly written book about writing. So I'm just trying to make that better at the moment. I'm just about to start my next YA book, which is exciting. And I'm doing bits and bobs in the TV world as well.
Can I ask how you I'm going to let you go then. But how do you divide your time? Like, how do you write? What's your rhythm of it?
It really depends. A thing that I've discovered recently that I really love is this thing called the Writer's Hour, which was set up by the London Writers Salon. And it's like a free Zoom where loads of really well-known writers join it as well at 8 a.m. BST, 8 a.m. EST and 8 a.m. PST. They just turn a Zoom on for an hour and everyone writes in silence for an hour. I can send you the link after.
I love the sound of
it's
that.
It's really good. Like, I usually do the 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, which is 1 p.m. one, because it's sort of in the middle of the day. Yeah. And it breaks up my day between like the afternoon, which is like meetings and kids, and the morning, which is like trying to get through stuff under contract. And then I break that up with like something that's sort of a bit more fun.
And kind of like anything goes, just whatever you want to write.
Yeah. But I'm a big believer in sort of setting myself realistic targets for the week. I don't like the whole write 1,000 words a day, because on the days like today where I'm knackered and I can't be bothered, I'll write 1,000 shit words and I'll have to deal with how shit they are in like 3 months' time. How about you? Now that you're like becoming a badass full-time writer, are you working out?
Full-time scares the bejesus out of me, because with Mother, I just did like tiny bits here and there. Like, you know, the idea of going and like renting an Airbnb and like, or even like, you know, spending 2 weeks just in my own head. Like, I've never done that, and it kind of scares me, the idea of it. I'm worried that like, if I wrote for like 6 hours a day every day, that I would not write anything at all. I don't know. I think I'd be like you. I'd need to flit from thing to thing, go out for a walk, come back. I don't know. I think it's that. But I'm trying to write something new at the moment, and I find that if I just write like random, just kind of short form stuff, just anything, stuff I saw, whatever, just to practice the art of writing, just to practice expressing stuff, painting pictures with words, and then kind of do that. And then, but in the morning, like have an hour every day where I just try and do like the bigger thing. But yeah, I'm learning. This is all ahead of me, Nikesh. I don't know. Like once radio stops in July, there should be a bit more time. So I'll figure out how it works.
The greatest
love the sound of that Zoom.
Yeah, it's
love the sound of that.
It's really great. And I think the greatest lesson I've learned is that writing isn't just sitting there with a Word document. So much other stuff goes on. Like, you know, when I'm working on a novel, I will curate a playlist of like stuff that fits the mood of the novel or stuff that the characters might listen to. I will read things. Like, I'm thinking of something that is along the lines of like, it's about a couple. So like, I reread an amazing novel called Open Water recently. I rewatched When Harry Met Sally. I started to rewatch 500 Days of Summer, and then realized that is a film that's not dated very well.
So it's like getting your head in the space, like in a kind of 360 degree way.
I've got like voice memos where like if I'm walking along and I just see a bit of graffiti, or if like a shop front or just like a way a person eats a banana on a bus or whatever, like it'll go into a voice note or into the notes app. Like it just feels like the more I allow myself to exist in the world that I'm trying to create when I'm not in front of the Word document, the more naturalistic it is when I sit down to actually write it.
And do it. Yeah. Nikesh, I thank you so much for your time. I'm aware that you're knackered and busy and got two kids, a lot on. So I really appreciate your time and your wisdom. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, and best of luck with the novel. It really is amazing, and I think it's going to go great.
Thank you so much to Nikesh Shukla there for the sage advice as I contemplate my own writing practice. You can buy the book we spoke about now. It's called Brown Baby, and it's just such a beautiful thing. Do go buy it. Remember to like, subscribe, pass it along, all of that, and do get in touch to let me know what you thought of this episode. After last week with Sophie Haywood, Flora said, love this chat, love Sophie's book. Buffy SJ said, your guests are fascinating and I cannot stop listening. This is what we like to hear. Next week, we're wrapping up the Mother Mother miniseries with a very inspiring story. It's Kieran Thapar, whose name you are hopefully about to see everywhere. He has written a completely game-changing study on the phenomenon of youth violence in the UK. It's called Cut Short. I wanted to talk to him because I knew that Kieran would have a lot to say about that incredibly volatile time in which a boy becomes a man. It's just another one of the big themes in Mother Mother as well. He told me all about the systemic societal issues that make that transition particularly difficult at this moment in time. And he also told me what we can all do to make a positive difference. It's such an inspiring conversation, and I really can't wait for you to hear it. Changes is produced by Frank Palmer, and we will be back next week. Until then, take care, enjoy the sunshine.